Welcome to Registry Matters, an independent production. Our opinions are our own, and we're thankful for our patrons. Your support makes what we do here possible. So, let's dive into today's discussion, and always remember, FYP.
Recording live from FYP Studios East and West, transmitting across the internet, this is episode 368 of Registry Matters. Larry, what is up on this fine Saturday evening? How are you?
Doing awesome. Glad you would have me back one more time.
Just once more. I don't know that we have enough, the line of people cycling through here is just so long. I don't know that I can squeeze you in yet another time, so you'll just have to let that one go in the future. Please do us a favor and show your support by hitting like and subscribe. 5-star review. You could hit the little thumbs up button in YouTube and all that. We appreciate it, and it helps us so very much. Larry, we did get two new patrons this week, and I will let you know who those are at the end. And without further ado, what are we doing tonight?
Well, we have a case from the Nebraska Court of Appeals. It's not a win, but it does provide some clarity in terms of what's needed for challenges to be successful. Also, we have an email from a listener regarding a legislative proposal pending in the great state of Michigan. And if time permits, we plan to do a legislative wrap-up from New Mexico, the Land of Enchantment.
How did you guys get the name of Land of Enchantment anyway?
I wish I knew.
Okay. Well, then I won't ask you. So, all right, well then, so we got all that. Okay, so we received this message from Wolf. And Wolf says he would like some request from a listener. Like I said, he's in Michigan. So he said, hey, I hope I'm not bothering you people. I just wanted to send along some more info about House Bill 5425, which I wrote you about earlier. And it is in the vaguely written bill that would restrict PFRs from working in any establishment that caters to minors. You know, if he reworded that, if they spelled that wrong, it would be craters to minors. And that would be funny if it said craters. But anyway, the establishment that caters to minors. And while it just got set up for a committee hearing on Wednesday morning, we need people to send their dismay over this bill to Melissa Sweet, committee clerk, and that's MSWEET at house.mi.gov.
Yes, he did. He did say that. Now, he didn't say the you people. I put that in there. He actually said you guys, but I wanted to embellish it a little bit. Right. We don't say that much anymore. And so, yes, there is a bill. I researched it to amend the what is known as the Sex Offenders Registration Act by adding a new section 5D. It reads as follows. An individual required to be registered under this act must not be an employee of a business that primarily provides services to individuals under the age of 18, including, but not limited to, a martial arts studio, dance studio, summer camp, tutoring service, youth sports venue, art and hobby class, mobile vending business, bowling alley, laser tag center, escape room, or any other business that allows for unsupervised access to individuals less than 18 years of age during activities.
They put together a pretty extensive, wide-ranging list of occupations.
They did. Indeed, that's an extensive list. Some of those businesses, I would think, also cater to adults, but I'm not sure what an escape room is. Can you enlighten me?
Yes, I've done a few of them. An escape room, it's a physical puzzle. Like I don't want to say it's a Rubik's Cube, but you go into a Cracker Barrel and they put the little puzzles on the table. And so you're locked in this themed room and you got to solve a series of clues and puzzles within a time limit. You know, maybe it's 60 minutes, maybe it's 90 minutes, and you have to quote unquote escape. And it's usually done in groups, and it's popular as a team building. Larry, you and I should go do one. We could do it as a team building. FYP could pay the bill for us to get together and do an escape room or a social activity.
Sounds good, but also that escape room sounds like the other occupations that were described, that's something that caters to adults. The adults also do escape rooms, right?
I think so. I mean, I was an adult when I did one, so I think that automatically sets it up that adults do it too. So, but what are your thoughts on the legislation?
I agree with the writer. It's both vague and overly broad and likely unconstitutional.
What do you know about the sponsor of the bill? That was, what's the name of the sponsor?
Well, I'm going to do what I never do. I usually give you these things I can't pronounce, but I'm going to take a gander at pronouncing this. His name is Matt Berlin.
I'll go with that. And, that sounds reasonable.
And Representative Berlin is in his second term in the Michigan House and was elected to serve in the 97th district in the November 22 election. The 97th district spans portions of Bay. These are the counties Genesee, Saginaw, Tuscola counties. Berlin serves as the vice chair of the House Oversight Committee. As a Tuscola native, Matthew has continued to serve the area and worked tirelessly so families and communities in the region can thrive. This is from his campaign and from his website. As a state representative, he has introduced plans to cut burdensome red tape and heavy-handed approaches from state government that have impacted small businesses, workers, families, while advocating for responsible plans to lower taxes and reduce other cost of labor burdens. Now, folks, listen to what I just said, and let's just see how this squares with what he says he's trying to do in this legislation.
So do you know anything about his legislative priorities?
Well, according to his website, Matthew has been a consistent leader on improving accountability and transparency within state government to improve Michigan's poor standing in this area. He introduced a plan during the 2023 and 24 legislative term to provide individual taxpayers who filed a return in the previous taxable year with an annual single-page revenue report via email explaining how tax dollars were allocated, and has supported other proposals that make state government more efficient for the people it's serving. The funny thing is to me that he's now sponsoring legislation that will have a significant impact on how businesses operate in Michigan. Also, his proposal, if enacted, will likely result in significant litigation expenses for the taxpayers of Michigan. So much for being fiscally responsible, but our voters never see these, what do we call that? Hypocrisy.
Oh, hypocrisy. You know, I have something for that, you know? Oh my God, I gotta find it really quick. Where's that button? Oh, there it is.
Well, don't worry about it.
Bigots, my admirers, is a farce. It's an act of hypocrisy. It's a terrible way to treat a guest on your show, and you know it.
So what do you think the chances that this will pass will be?
Well, that's hard to say since I don't have direct knowledge of his track record. I can say that based on his website, his track record of getting things enacted is probably not very good. Otherwise, he would not have to resort to bragging about bills he's introduced. Instead, he would be bragging about bills that he has passed. And folks, that's a tip to you. When someone talks about what they've introduced, it means it didn't pass. And they rely on the voters being all enamored by what they've introduced. You didn't pass it.
You know, like, seriously, maybe a month ago, maybe 6 weeks ago, we sort of started talking about that. We were analyzing something, and we were talking about the particular legislator that introduced it, and he has introduced things, but he's never passed anything. I'd never considered, like, a quote-unquote scorecard of how they introduce versus what gets passed. I'd never, ever considered it.
Most voters don't, and that's why this is such a beautiful legislative website, because he's using all these buzz phrases. He's introduced this and he's for that, and nobody analyzes how that contradicts with what he's proposed. This is a major intrusion into the private sector from a guy who claims to be for keeping government off people's back. But go ahead.
All right. Well, then, so then what is the penalty for violating if this becomes law?
Well, according to the bill, an individual who violates a section is guilty of a misdemeanor punishable by imprisonment of not more than a year and a fine of not more than $1,000, or both. A second or subsequent violation is a felony punishable by imprisonment for not more than 4 years and a fine of not more than $2,000, or both. Now, remember, he's keeping both. Cost of government down while he's putting somebody in prison for potentially 4 years. But Michigan would be on the higher tier of cost for prisons. So $50,000 a year, we're going to spend $200,000 to put a person for working in an escape room. I mean, you got to admit that that's funny. Please admit that that's funny.
Well, then what about who should they contact about this?
Well, the writer recommended, I'm going to go by what the writer said because I don't know Michigan process. But I'm going to add a little bit on top of that. He recommended you contact the committee clerk, which we provided that address, and we can do it again. But also, they should contact members of, in my opinion, of the House Judiciary Committee, especially if you live in one of Judiciary members' districts. And we've provided a link. I'm sure you can disseminate it with this program. That'll give you a list of who serves on the Judiciary Committee. If you happen to be one of our 500 or so listeners in Michigan, see if you live in one of their districts and contact them and tell them how you feel about this and discuss their hypocrisy with them. That's okay to do that as long as you're respectful.
Don't say that they're a bunch of losers and bad mouths and whatnot.
No, you wouldn't want to do that, but you could say, I'm just struggling with this because this is going to cause people to be in prison at a huge cost to us. And it's going to cause a lot of intrusion into businesses because they're not going to know how to discern whether they're covered or not. So the offender is not going to know, have clarity, and businesses are not going to know how to supervise their people. And they're going to have to put people on to supervise because it says unsupervised, right? So this is going to be a cluster of a mess. And have that discussion with them and find out if they're as pro-business as what they claim they are.
So I think what they should do, Larry, is they should get some, you know, maybe like finished warehouses that haven't been rented, and they should go in there and they should rent those places, and they should just load it up with beds and lock everybody up.
Sounds pretty good to me. You want to give that email address again for the House Judiciary Clerk?
It's actually a pretty easy address since it's Melissa Sweet. So it's msweet@house.mi.gov.
So,
and all right. Well,
do me a favor. Make sure you write the email yourself. Don't have AI write it. Don't disseminate the same email to 300 people and tell them to send it, because if they operate like we did, we blacklisted those and we never looked at them when they. So write it yourself.
And honestly, Larry, at this stage of the game, if anybody writes the same email, like if they just copy and paste, it's so easy to flip something around so that it's at least not the same thing every time. It's just so easy now. All right, well then, let's talk about this thing that you put in here, this case from the Court of Appeals of Nebraska. Now, I've read it. I was doing it all day. I was hanging up cameras around the house. I was doing some coding. I was doing some homework, and I was reading this. I had this off to the side. I had my little finger going across the paper. I can't find anything exciting, any exciting news out of this. Did I miss something?
No, there's not really much exciting news in this decision.
It is from Nebraska. How exciting could it be? But you want to discuss it for what reason exactly?
For educational purposes, because I've been involved in this Nebraska fiasco since 2009.
So for the 12 people that live in Nebraska, and so this is an appeal that is from Lincoln County, Nebraska, home to more tumbleweed than people. Where is Lincoln County?
It's in the western half of Nebraska. The largest city is North Platte, which is the county seat, and the population of the entire county is approximately 35,000.
Jeepers. All right, the district court for Lincoln County dismissed the charge against Matthew J. Earhart for failure to report an address change pursuant to Nebraska's PFR Registration Act. The state appealed, arguing that the court erred in finding that Earhart was required to register under SOAR for only 10 years, rather than 25 years as required by the 2009 amendments. Now, I believe you worked on Nebraska's PFR registration statute so many number of years ago.
I did indeed. And at one time, I moved to New Mexico, Nebraska was high on my list. And in fact, I resided at the downtown YMCA in Omaha for a few months while I was considering occupational opportunities there, which were plentiful back then. I just didn't like that cold climate. I was leaving one cold climate, and I was going to another one in Omaha, so I decided to come on a little further south.
A little bit, little further, huh? So you resided where, though? Tell me that again.
The YMCA, once known as Young Men's Christian Association.
If I only had a clip really quick, Larry, that could be like, YMCA, you know, whatever. Anyway, so let's go over some background. In November of 2002, Earhart was charged with first-degree naughty activities with a child for subjecting a person of less than 16 years of age to naughty behavior, a Class 2 felony. Then in May of 2003, he pled no contest to the lesser charge of sexual assault of a child, a Class 3A felony. The district court sentenced him to 240 days imprisonment, and he was informed His conviction subjected him to SOAR's registration requirements. At the time of Earhart's sentencing, the relevant part of SORA stated, any person to whom SORA applies shall be required to register during any period of supervised release, probation, or parole, and shall continue to comply with the act for a period of 10 years after the date of discharge from probation, parole, or supervised release from incarceration. Which date is most recent? Nebraska Revised Statute Section 29-4005. And that's from 2002. That seemed to be clear enough to me that his 10 years would have expired. However, what changed?
Well, in 2009, the Nebraska legislature amended SORA to provide for different durations of registration depending on the severity of the offender's crime. And also, it's not in the script, but they also illuminated people to the public. It was a risk-based system where only a few of the offenders were on the website, but they turned full throttle on the website. And as a result of those amendments, the same section 29405, 2016, currently provides a pertinent part. The full registration period is as follows. 15 years if a PFR was convicted of a registrable offense under this section, not punishable by imprisonment more than 1 year, which is a very small list. Then 25 years if the PFR was convicted of a registrable offense under this section, punishable by imprisonment of more than 1 year, or life if the PFR was convicted of a registrable offense under section 29-4003, punishable by more than a year, and was convicted of an aggravated offense, or had a prior sex offense conviction, or has been determined to be a lifetime registered in another state, territory, commonwealth, or a jurisdiction of the United States. So, on and on about court martial and so forth. They basically, you've got the Adam Walsh Act mostly in their tiering system that they adopted in 2009.
Well, then the opinion says in August 2024, the state charged Earhart with failure to report an address change, second offense, to the Lincoln County Sheriff on June 21st, as required by SORA. Then in October, Earhart filed a motion to dismiss the action. In his motion, he averred that he was convicted of a misdemeanor sexual assault in Colorado, that he was ordered to register as a PFR for a period of 10 years, and that the 10-year period had expired. Well, what happened next?
Well, the district court did the proper thing. They set a hearing, had it briefed. The hearing was held on Earhart's motion to dismiss in November 2024. Earhart asserted that he was being told by the state that he had registered under SORA for his entire life. Earhart argued that that violated his right against double jeopardy and the federal constitution's ex post facto clause. Earhart maintained that the state was barred from increasing its registration duration retroactively, as his original plea agreement stipulated he would have to register for only 10 years. That is peculiar to me because they normally never put it in the plea agreement, but he says it's there. I don't have that document.
Okay. So then what was the state of Nebraska's response?
They articulated they were not, that it was not concerned with his Colorado conviction, but instead argued that Nebraska's 2003 conviction subjected him to lifetime registration under the 2009 amendments to SOAR. I actually agree with the state. Literally, that's what it would have done. Earhart asserted his belief that his period of registration for his 2003 conviction ended in 2012. Remember, that's 3 years after they had the amendments in 2009. Neither party presented any evidence about Earhart's Colorado conviction.
Can you go into some detail about what the trial court did?
Well, sure. They issued an order granting his motion to dismiss the criminal charge for failure to provide the address change. The district court determined that to apply lifetime registration to Earhart, there had to be either one, a previous conviction of a PFR offense, or two, an aggravated charge offense. The district court found that neither of those requirements existed. The court had no information about the Colorado conviction other than it occurred in 2006 and that Earhart was required to register for a period of 10 years. Therefore, in applying the 2003 statute, the court determined Earhart was required to register under SORA for a period of only 10 years, which had ended in 2013. As such, it concluded Earhart was not subject to SORA on June 21st, 2024, the date he was alleged to have failed to report the address change.
And of course, the state appealed.
Yes. Now, remember, this is the state that's real conservative with money, and they watch every dollar like a hawk. and they don't waste a single penny of taxpayers' resource. You've got that right.
Yes, of course.
Yes. So yes, they did appeal.
All right. So then the state asserted in 2009 amendments to SORA apply to Earhart's Earhart's sentence and lengthen the period he was subjected to SORA from 10 to 25 years. Now, how did they justify that position?
Well, as previously stated, SORA 29-4005, subsection 1B2, as amended in 2009, provides that the registration period is 25 years if the PFR was convicted of a registrable offense under 29-4003. Imprisonment from carries potential imprisonment for more than 1 year. Earhart was convicted of PFR assault of a child, and that was a Class 3A felony, which at the time of conviction had a maximum sentence of 5 years. Well, that is more than 1 year, right?
I believe five is more than one, yes. I believe yes, so.
So, and then they looked at the statute, and it now carries a maximum of 3 years, which is bizarre that it went down. But still, three is more than one. So the state argued that because Earhart was convicted of a registrable offense that it was and continues to be punishable by more than a year, he's required to register for a period of 25 years. And that's what they argued.
So then how did Earhart counter that argument?
He countered it with just simply saying that the retroactive application of the amendment violates the ex post facto clauses of the U.S. and Nebraska constitutions.
Yeah, but it's a civil regulatory scheme. All right, so both the U.S. and Nebraska constitutions provide that no ex post facto law may be passed. A law which purports to apply to events that occurred before the law's enactment and which disadvantages a defendant from creating or enhancing penalties that did not exist when the offense was committed is an ex post facto law and will not be endorsed by the courts.
But the retroactive application of civil disabilities and sanctions is permitted. As the court pointed out, it is only criminal punishment that ex post facto clause prohibits.
Then the court stated the relevant question is whether 29-4005 imposes civil sanctions or criminal punishment. How do they make that determination?
Well, that's quite strange. You should ask that. To determine whether, this is what the court said, to determine whether criminal statute imposes a civil sanctions or criminal punishment, a court must apply two-pronged tests. And they cited State versus Harris, which is a state case, and then they also referenced Smith versus Doe, which I think you've heard of from 2003.
I have heard of that one.
And under this test, if the intention of the legislature was to impose punishment, the inquiry is terminated, because if they intended that, we assume that you did what you intended, so there's no need to examine further. It's unconstitutional. If, however, the intention was to enact a civil regulatory scheme that is civil, non-punitive, the court must further examine whether the statutory scheme is so punitive, either in purpose or effect, as to negate the state's intention to deem it, quote, civil. And then they say, because we know ordinarily to defer to the legislature's stated intent, only the clearest of proof, remember, only the clearest of proof, will suffice to override that intent and transform what has been denominated as a civil regulatory remedy into a criminal penalty. Now, how would we go about having the clearest of proof? We'll get to that in another episode.
Well, here we go again. How do they make that determination? I know what's coming without even knowing. I know.
Well, they apply the Kennedy versus Mendoza-Martinez test as established by the United States Supreme Court in 1963, and that's 372 U.S. at 144.
You have that like tattooed on your forehead, don't you? You know that one inside and out, yeah. Don't you?
Well, I have to read it, but I'll go through the factors of what they chose. There's actually seven, but they are, I don't think they relied on all seven of them, but let's just go through them. Number one, whether the sanction or that scheme involves any affirmative disability or restraint. Well, in Nebraska, I don't believe there are any restraints in state law whatsoever. I don't remember anyone who last worked on that. Whether the regime has historically been regarded as punishment. Whether it comes into play only on a finding of scienter. And not even the lawyers can explain that one. I think I can, but most of the lawyers can't.
I agree with you.
Whether the operation will promote the traditional aims of punishment, retribution, and deterrence. Whether the behavior to which it applies is already a crime. Whether an alternative purpose to which it may rationally be connected is assignable for it, and I don't understand that one, and whether it appears excessive in relation to the alternative purpose assigned. I don't understand either one of those two, but I understand the one that the lawyers can't understand.
All right. The Nebraska Supreme Court has previously found that the legislature enacted SORA to establish a civil regulatory scheme to protect the public from PFRs. State versus Harris. What is SUPRA, by the way?
That we previously mentioned it. That's the case has already been cited.
Okay.
We discussed it. It's up above.
Okay. Well, I mean, the actual, what is SUPRA? Is that an abbreviation of something?
That's what it means. It means we already discussed it above. So when you cite a case over and over again, that's what you say.
I thought you were telling me that we talked about it before, but I got you now. All right.
No.
Well, that decision was made prior to 2009, to the 2009 amendments, right?
Correct. And they have to begin the inquiry by determining legislative intent, because that starts the new inquiry if they're going to examine if anything's changed since 2009.
All right, and then the court noted that the bill was to bring Nebraska in compliance with the AWA, the Adam Walsh Act, from 2006. And the court referred to the introducer's statement of intent, which read, "The purpose of the Adam Walsh Act Protection Safety Act of 2006 is to protect the public, in particular the chirins, from violent PFRs via a more comprehensive nationalized system for registration of PFRs."
They did say that. And they stated also that the statement of intent shows that SORA has a dual purpose, protecting the public from PFRs and conforming to national standards, various aspects of PFR registration requirements. And then they referred again to the introducer's statement of intent in Legislative Bill 285. Therefore, the court determined that it was the legislature's intent in amending 29-40005 to reform the civil regulatory scheme for PFR registration, and it was not the legislature's intent to punish. Now, you can't imagine they would intend to punish anybody, do you?
No, definitely not. I believe that they intend to pose disabilities and restraints, though. All right, well, then they went on to the intent effects analysis, or the Kennedy-Mendoza-Martinez factors. The court stated, "These are the Kennedy versus Mendoza-Martinez factors we consider most relevant to our analysis. And that is, number one, whether the statute promotes the traditional aims of punishment, retribution, and deterrence. Number two, whether it imposes an affirmative disability and restraint. Number three, whether it has been regarded in our history and traditions as punishment. Number four, whether it has a rational or alternative non-punitive purpose. And lastly, whether or not it is excessive with respect to that purpose." Can we go through them?
Certainly.
All right. So what did they decide on number one? Whether the statute promotes the traditional aims of punishment, which would be retribution and deterrence.
They said, although failure to comply with SORA imposes a criminal penalty, such punishment is not for behavior that occurred before the statute's enactment. Listen carefully, folks. Compliance is not retribution for a crime that resulted in a person being subject to SORA. Instead, it punishes the action of failing to comply once the person is subject to registration requirements. Therefore, an increase in the durational period of registration is not retributive, because registration is not punishment at all. You make the analogy, if we learn that a restaurant needs to have higher temperatures to keep food safe, and they change the law, you're not trying to punish the restaurant. You're telling them, hey, the regulatory framework has changed. We've got new information. We've changed what we do. You've got to upgrade your system or we're going to shut you down. It's not punitive at all.
And that wouldn't be retroactive, right?
I mean, it would be retroactive. You've got to do it now.
Right. But I'm saying, like, you didn't have your temperatures high enough yesterday. We changed the law today. Since you didn't have it high enough yesterday, you're being fined?
Oh, you don't get fined for yesterday. You got to bring your restaurant up to compliance.
Right.
And that's what you got to do. You got to bring your vessel up to compliance. You had to go in for 10 years. Now you have to go in for 25.
All right. And then what about your favorite number, which is number two, and whether it is imposes an affirmative disability and restraint? I really like that one a lot, Larry. I think that's really awesome.
It didn't very much better. It says, we have determined that 29-4005 imposes no affirmative disability or restraint. as it does not prohibit a PFR from doing anything that the PFR would otherwise be able to do. In other words, you can work anywhere you want to, they'll hire you. You can live anywhere you want to, they'll rent to you. You can go anywhere you want to, and you can stay out as late as night. You can smoke all the dope you want to. Now, you may break another law, but you're not breaking the PFR law. You don't have a curfew. You don't have to account to a probation officer. You're not under direct supervision. You just have to report in periodically. So they're saying that there's no disability restraint. This is a disadvantage when you litigate in a state where they don't have all the stuff that Mississippi has, where you have to pay a $500 fee every so often to notify right. your neighbors, and you can't work here and you can't live there. You can't build this property. You can't go to your schools. You can do all those things in Nebraska.
And so then moving on to the third factor, whether it has been regarded in our history and traditions as punishment?
They said, we find that SORA and the sex offender registration requirements have not historically been punishment. So that one didn't do much better.
Wait, so I mean, if we always treat these people like crap, then historically, does that mean it's not punishment, since we don't consider it punishment that they can't live in all these places? So therefore it's normal, therefore it's not punitive?
No, that's not what they're saying. They're saying that to look at something that's considered punishment, we would have to look at what types of things have been historically regarded as punishment. Requiring someone to register has never been considered punishment in the past, in our history. So if you're an originalist, which all of our audience claims that they are, there's no historical precedent for you to say that having to fill out a form and go see somebody periodically is punishment. That's what they're saying.
I got you. All right, then moving on to the fourth factor, whether it has a rational, alternative, non-punitive purpose. I'm really trying hard to understand those words in that order to figure out what this may mean. So what does it mean? What did the court say?
Well, the court held it is not excessive in relation to that purpose, as registration in and of itself is not excessive for the purpose of protecting the public and enhancing future law enforcement efforts. Simply increasing the time for such registration under SORA cannot be considered to be to exceed that purpose. There is some logic in them saying that. If it works, wouldn't it work gooder if we did it for a longer period of time?
Yes, and more intensely at that. And then the increase in requirements passed in 2009. Has the Nebraska Supreme Court ruled on this one?
No, they have not. There was a challenge filed immediately after the enactment of LB 285. They filed in federal court and lost. They did a good job. So I'm not knocking the people. I mean, they were the only state I've ever seen raise as much money as they did, as quick as they did. And they went and found a competent attorney and they filed it in federal court. But the Nebraska Supreme Court has not addressed whether changing the registration requirements from 10 to 25 years under 29-4005 is an ex post facto violation. So they turned to other courts. They said, however, the court has considered similar issues. For instance, in State versus Worm, which was a 2004 case, the defendant was required to register for 10 years at the time of his offense, but based on subsequent amendments, the registration increased from 10 years to lifetime. The court determined in Worm that the registration provisions were not punitive in either purpose or effect, and therefore was not an ex post facto violation.
Now, is there hope that this case can be overturned by the Nebraska Supreme Court?
Not very likely, I don't think. And I can expand a little bit more. The case that they launched was a good case. And they got a federal judge that was very thoughtful, named Koff. I forget his first name. Maybe it was Richard, K-O-P-F. And Judge Koff did not want to blow up SORNA. Yeah, he's a federal judge, and he didn't want to blow up SORNA. But he looked at the most egregious things in that act, which included monitoring your computers. And he struck several things. And we have the decision in the Dropbox folder that we share if you want to make it available to the audience. The final decision came out in 2012. He immediately granted an injunction and did not allow the state to do all those wicked things that were in the bill. But he did not stray beyond the things that were blatantly unconstitutional. The registration framework he allowed to stay in place, and that's where we are. There were cases pending simultaneously. I know one in Sarpy County, which is a suburb of Omaha, and that case was stopped, not by order, but by voluntarily being the federal judge in Sarpy County decided that he was going to defer to Judge Koff. And Judge Koff did this thorough 73-page ruling that's in our folder. And if everybody wants to see how Judge Koff came to his decision, I'd welcome you to read through it, because I think there's a lot of good stuff to learn. I read it several times years ago. I didn't read it today, so I don't remember all the details, but he was very thoughtful in his ruling.
Well, very well. So not likely to be flipped over in our favor, is what you're saying.
Well, I would like to think that if the Nebraska Constitution has a greater protection than the U.S. Constitution, I would go back into state court if it were me. And I would try to build a case from scratch that has a strong evidentiary record. This one may not have the evidentiary record below that shows the punitive nature, because this sounds like it was only briefed and there was a hearing. Don't know how long the hearing was. But you need expert witnesses. You need to be able to prove that this is punishing people and how. Opining is not enough. Remember, clearest of proof. And you need to build that evidentiary record. And if you don't do that, you're going to keep losing. I think we have a quote for that one, too, a little soundtrack for that.
That one I don't know. Which one?
Macon Kelly.
Oh, I don't have that one handy. I've tried to track it down, Richard, and I can't find it.
Are you a first-time listener of Registry Matters? Well, then make us a part of your daily routine and subscribe today. Just search for Registry Matters through your favorite podcast app. Hit the subscribe button and you're off to the races. You can now enjoy hours of sarcasm and snark from Andy and Larry on a weekly basis. Oh, and there's some excellent information thrown in there too. Subscribing also encourages others of you people to get on the bandwagon and become regular Registry Matters listeners. So what are you waiting for? Subscribe to Registry Matters right now. Help us keep fighting and continue to say FYP.
But, all right, well then, let's cover the, this one's going to be pretty quick. This is from your people's legislative session that just ended. Can we talk about how things went?
Sure, we can talk about it.
Now, listen, you shared with me like the online streaming link, so I followed every legislative update, so I'm ready. Are you ready? I don't think you're ready. You're not ready. Are you ready?
I hope so.
House Bill number 69 sought to modify the statute of limitations for civil actions related to sexual abuse. It proposed to amend section 37-1-30 NMSA. What is SA? I got New Mexico. What's the SA?
Statutes annotated.
Okay. So a New Mexico statute annotated to allow alleged victims until they have reached 58 years of age. Well, you're way older than you got nothing to worry about to resuscitate an already expired statute of limitations for civil actions due to childhood sexual abuse. Did it pass?
Well, now it's the victim that has to be that's being extended to 58, not the perpetrator.
Oh, crap.
If they were diddled at 14, that's a long time before you reach 58.
I'm sorry, if they were what?
Diddled. If they were abused at 14.
Well, and then theoretically, the person doing it is probably going to be 10-ish or more years. And if they're 58, then they're like pushing 70 or something. You don't want to put people in prison at the age of 70, man, because like that's going to be a lot of medical expenses. It's just going to be, that doesn't sound good. All right, anyway, please continue, sir.
No, it died because it was not germane to this year's session. It needed a message from the governor, which it did not have. I don't know why it didn't get a message, but it didn't move forward this year. It will come back next year, and we'll have to deal with it. But this year, we didn't have to do a whole lot of work on it.
And then House Bill 74 would have eliminated the 10-year statute of limitations on prior felonies. Did that one pass?
No. The bill was heard by the House Consumer and Public Affairs Committee on February 3rd. It did not receive the necessary votes to advance, so we were able to extinguish that one in its tracks. But it'll come back.
And then House Bill 79 sought to make it easier for the state to revoke a person's probation. The language proposed in House Bill 79 would reduce the burden of proof to a preponderance of the evidence. Did that one pass?
No, it died. It did pass the first committee. We objected because the legal standard of preponderance of evidence is inadequate and not appropriate in criminal proceedings. And I want to give kudos to the Republicans on the committee that served. They're in a minority, but the Republicans, for whatever their reasons, I don't know what they are, they voted no. So I'll have to try to dig into it, find out if it wasn't strong enough or what, but they did vote no, and the D's voted yes. So right now the Republicans get kudos for voting no.
And then House Bill 199 sought to bring New Mexico into substantial compliance with the federal Adam Walsh Act. Did that one pass?
No, it did not. It did pass the House Consumer and Public Affairs Committee with only one no vote, and that was the chair. The proposal is not perfect, and we have worked to improve the language of legislation. We could grudgingly live with it the way it was, but it died. It died in the House Judiciary Committee because of the either someone was working against it, because I was honestly not working against it. I was going to try to tweak a few things if it kept moving, but it died in House Judiciary, so we didn't get that one passed. So there's no change in our PFR Registration Act.
All right, and then Senate Bill 32, it sought to revise the time limitation for commencing prosecution of human trafficking, increase the age applicable to victims of sexual exploitation of children by prostitution to 18, amend the elements of human trafficking, provide a definition of harm, prohibit certain defenses in a prosecution for certain crimes, add victims of human trafficking and sexual exploitation of children to the Victims of Crime Act, prohibit earned meritorious deductions for a human trafficking sentence. Did that one pass?
No. And this was really bad. I mean, when you eliminate the, remember, you serve all your time here. We don't have parole, but we do give meritorious deductions, and it's either 15% or 50%, depending on which crime it is. And when you start blocking out prohibitions against the meritorious deductions, then people are serving their full 100% of their sentence, which does what? It increases the cost of incarceration, the cost of running the prisons, populations go higher. So that was a problem with it. Anytime you let the legislature prohibit certain defenses, that is really problematic. You say this shall not be a defense. I don't like that. But no, it didn't pass. It did. It passed the Senate Health and Public Affairs Committee, but it died in the Senate Judiciary Committee.
And then I think this is the last one. This one was the biggie, and this was Senate Bill 41. It sought to eliminate the statute of limitations for certain PFR-type crimes. Did that one pass?
It did pass on the final day of the session. And I was disappointed in that. There were so many opportunities that I even tried to engineer rolling the PFR bill in there, because if we're going to get something bad, I wanted to get something good out of it. And I thought I had a commitment to roll the PFR bill into it, and then I could have lived with it. But that fell apart, so I haven't had fully enough time to analyze the various amendments. But I'll tell you this, because I'm not going to sugarcoat it. The liberals pushed this through because of their fixation on Jeffrey Epstein. And I'm confident that there will be people convicted of crimes that they did not commit, because one cannot receive a fair trial when they are facing decades-old charges. So, but as far as the nuances of the amendments, there were so many put on the House and the Senate removed, and then they were added back, and then it went, there were four amendments, so I haven't had a chance to totally dissect what the final version looks like. But this was something driven by the liberal side of the aisle, so let's be fair. It was not, they didn't try to block it on the conservative side, but it wasn't their agenda. They didn't have enough votes, and this was our side pushing this.
And you're not happy about this one, right?
I'm not happy at all, because we get a lot of lip service about fairness, and they have totally forgotten about fairness. And I watched the testimony as much as I could, and the state representatives of the state agencies, not the state representatives, but the agency representatives from the AG's office and from the various law enforcement apparatus, they talked about how this doesn't change the burden of proof. And they're technically correct. It doesn't. But what it does do is, when you bring a person in 40 years later, a lot of things have changed in 40 years, including people who are alive that might have been able to help you, that would be able to provide evidence on your behalf. If a witness that could contradict the alleged victim to say, that's not what the alleged victim told me at the time, we both worked there together, and that person is dead, you really can't call them as a witness, can you?
I'm pretty sure we don't have seance level interactions with dead people in court.
And it also, we don't know what evidence has been destroyed that might have been beneficial, because there's not a limitless supply of places to keep evidence. So we don't know what's been lost. We don't know what's spoiled. And one of the most important things, we don't know about the human memory. What we do know is that memories change over time.
Yep.
When people are recollecting something that's decades old, in particular, had encouragement to do so. So we know that you can't get a fair trial. And I'm saying precisely the exact same thing I said when Judge Roy Moore in Alabama was being hit with all these accusations from when he worked as a supervisor in the Old Hickory House. I believe it was the Old Hickory House restaurant. And I said the same thing. This is nonsensical because there's no way he could get a fair trial. The Old Hickory House has been closed for decades. People have vanished into oblivion, died. It hasn't changed. It doesn't matter what party you're in. You can't get a fair trial. And the liberals don't seem to care about that anymore.
All right. So if you're 100 years old and they want to bring up something that's 50 years old, like you got to figure out how to defend yourself. You've got to hire an attorney. You've got to figure out how to defend yourself from something that's that old.
So, well, I feel bad. I know that people are going to be charged. And even if they're exonerated, they're going to spend a lot of money dealing with this stuff from decades ago.
All right, then. Anything else before we get out of here?
Well, I did receive a request, and I don't know that I can say no, but Chance, our former co-host that hasn't joined us for a while, he texted me today, and he said he did a podcast on Timothy Busfield, the charges that he's facing in New Mexico. And he said if people want to know the down and dirty, that you can find it on his podcast. So therefore, since I'm not planning on covering Busfield, if you want to find out, you can go to our colleague's podcast and see what he had to say. I don't know can we provide any linkage to that or not, because he did just release an episode.
I will do it. I'm looking it up right now. To come up with, I forgot that it's almost like the sex offender trials podcast or something.
Yes. Well, he's getting good traction. I'll send it to you, but yeah, he's getting good traction. He's had 500 views on it and it's only been out for about a month, and that's a pretty good amount of views. So people are interested.
Very well. And we did, it was only one. So it seems like it was two people, but I think they accidentally used the wrong name. So they joined twice and then one of them got canceled. Anyway, so that was Josh as a new patron. So thank you very much, Josh, for coming on board and becoming a patron. Really appreciate it. So head over to registrymatters.co for show notes, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. You can also visit FYP Education, where a lot of free resources are available, including the new search tool that was created. You can send us some email that people have done, registrymatterscast@gmail.com. You can certainly leave old-fashioned voicemail messages, which I always just forward over to Larry. And that's 747-227-4477. And lastly, to support us, it is so very much appreciated. It means so much that at patreon.com/registrymatters, and you can become a patron and gain all the perks that go along with that. That's all I got, man. You got anything else before we go?
Nope. We had a good episode. We finished in less than 3 hours.
We did. Well, have a great night. Have a good rest of the weekend. And if you're listening live, as the dozens and dozens and dozens of people are doing, I really appreciate you guys hanging out, and we'll talk to y'all soon. Have a great night, Larry.
Good night.
For you to come back and...
Oh, damn it. Wrong button. Yes. Okay. 7 in the morning, huh?
You've been listening to FYP.